under his arm. Etienne had arranged for him to borrow it. He read the book again and again, especially the part about Georges Méliès. He stared into the face of the man in the moon. Suddenly, he heard a loud knock on his door.
Hugo? It's me, Isabel.
Hugo jumped up and opened the door. Isabel had brought her own flashlight. She walked with crutches, and her foot was bandaged.
What are you doing here? He asked. How did you even get here with crutches? Everyone thinks I'm in bed. It took me a long time to climb out my window and make my way here.
They sat down on the bed, and Isabel immediately started to cry.
What is it? Hugo said.
I'm sorry I slammed your fingers in the door, and I'm sorry I didn't tell my godparents that I stole the notebook. I was mad at you for taking my key.
Which you stole, Hugo said.
Isabel ignored him and kept talking.
And now, Papa George is very sick. His fever is so high and he's talking to himself. He just mumbles strange things like a wingless bird, a burned-up building, a splinter, a fly, a grain of sand. I'm so worried about him. I've never seen him sick before.
What if he dies? He's not going to die, said Hugo.
You don't know that. Papa George supports all of us. What would we do? Mama Jean called a doctor, who wrapped up my foot and gave us a prescription for Papa George. But with the toy booth closed, we have no money to get the medicine, or for anything else.
Everything's going to be all right, Hugo said. But first, I have to show you something.
Hugo handed her the book from the Film Academy library, open to the page with the film still of the rocket in the moon's eye. Isabel stared at it in disbelief.
That's what the machine drew.
Read it.
Isabel read the pages about her godfather.
Papa George made movies? I can't believe it. But he won't even let me go to the movies.
My father saw this movie when he was a boy, said Hugo, who pointed to the still from A Trip to the Moon. He described this scene to me. I recognized it when the automaton drew the picture.
Hugo told her about his trip to the Film Academy library and seeing Etienne again. Isabel put down the book.
Why did Papa George stop making movies? How did he end up at the train station?
She stretched out her leg.
Why didn't anyone ever tell me any of this?
Before I left the Film Academy library, said Hugo, I told Etienne everything that was going on, and he brought me to meet his teacher, the one who wrote this book. I could tell that they didn't really believe me, so I,
What did you do?
Asked Isabel.
I invited them to come to your apartment.
You what?
Etienne and René Tabard are coming to your apartment next week. Monsieur Tabard wants to see your godfather for himself.
Mama Jean will never allow the visit.
Then don't tell her about it, just wait till they show up.
That's a very bad idea, Hugo.
Well, I could cancel the visit, but I don't think we should.
This is how we can find out everything.
Don't mention this to your godmother yet. Don't tell her about the book or ask her any questions. Let's wait until Etienne and Monsieur Tabard come. Then she'll see that there are people who are happy her husband is alive, who remember him. And she'll answer our questions. I'm sure she will.
Isabel shook her head. She looked very confused.
You know, you never told me where you got the mechanical man.
Hugo had never told anyone the whole story. It had been his secret for so long that he wasn't sure he even had the words. But he looked at Isabel,
and it was as if he could feel all the cogs and wheels begin to engage in his mind, and the words suddenly came together.
He related the whole story, from his father's discovery of the automaton up in the attic of the museum, to the fire, to the arrival and disappearance of his uncle. He told her about discovering the toys in her godfather's booth and how he used them to fix the automaton. He told her everything. When Hugo finished, Isabel was quiet for a few moments. Then she said,
Thank you.
For what?
For telling me.
Come by the booth tomorrow after school. I have an idea.
But the booth will be closed.
No, it won't, said Hugo.
Chapter 6. Purpose.
The next morning, Hugo opened the toy booth and set it up exactly the way the old man always did. His fingers were still hurting badly, but he smiled as the customers straggled by and he collected the money. Still, there were long stretches of quiet. Hugo was frustrated not being able to draw or play with any of the mechanical parts. He tried to teach himself to write with his left hand, but it didn't work. He looked closely at the wind-up toys. He tried to imagine what the old man was thinking as he built these toys. He must have hated being stuck here all day long. Maybe he was only happy for the time he devoted to building each new toy. Maybe they reminded him of building the automaton. When Isabel came by after school, she joined Hugo on a stool behind the counter. Eventually, with no customers and nothing else to say, Isabel tended to the loose ends of Hugo's bandages and took out a book. She began reading. Hugo recognized the book. It was the collection of Greek myths she had borrowed from Monsieur Labisse.
"You've been reading that for a long time," said Hugo. "Oh, I've read it 20 times. I bring it back to the bookshop, read other books, and then take it again. I like the stories." "Read out loud."
Isabel read the stories to Hugo, and he remembered hearing some of the myths when he was in school. She read about Mount Olympus and creatures like the Chimera and the Phoenix, and then read the story of Prometheus. Hugo learned that Prometheus had created humankind out of mud and then stole fire from the gods as a gift for the people he had made so they could survive.
So Prometheus was a thief.
In his mind, Hugo suddenly saw the painting in the Film Academy library. One of the figure's hands was reaching up, holding a ball of fire, as if it were stealing the flames from above, and the other hand projected light, like it was a film. Hugo thought that maybe the painting was a version of Prometheus, except Prometheus was stealing fire from the gods to create the movies. Isabel continued reading the story. It turned out that Prometheus was punished for his theft by being chained forever to a rock where an eagle came to eat his liver, which grew back every day. Prometheus had stolen the fire because he wanted to help the people he had created, yet he was still punished. Hugo had become a thief to survive and to help the automaton. What would his punishment be? Was he now going to spend the rest of his life behind the counter of this toy booth, like the old man? Was this all he had to look forward to? Hugo tried to push that idea out of his head. There had to be something else. He found his attention being drawn to the clock across the hall. The big bronze hands moved slowly across the clock's face, like the sun across the sky. He wondered when it was going to stop running. Hugo looked at his injured fingers and wished he would be able to use them again soon. He opened the drawer and pulled out the blue mechanical mouse, which he unwrapped carefully.
"What's that?" asked Isabel. "It's the toy I was stealing when your godfather caught me. I broke it, and he made me fix it. I don't know why he kept it." "He must like you," Isabel said. "In his dresser at home, he has all the drawings I made him when I was little."
Hugo smiled. Then Isabel wound up the mouse. They watched it skitter across the counter. Hugo thought about his father's description of the automaton.
"Did you ever notice that all machines are made for some reason?" he asked Isabel. "They are built to make you laugh, like the mouse here, or to tell the time, like clocks, or to fill you with wonder, like the automaton. Maybe that's why a broken machine always makes me a little sad, because it isn't able to do what it was meant to do."
Isabel picked up the mouse, wound it again, and set it down.
"Maybe it's the same with people," Hugo continued. "If you lose your purpose, it's like you're broken. Like Papa George. Maybe we can fix him. How do we do that? I don't know, but maybe René Tabard can help us when he visits next week. He'll know what to do."
Hugo and Isabel were quiet for a moment, and then Isabel said,
"So what is your purpose? Fixing things?"
Hugo thought about it.
"I don't know," he said. "Maybe." "Then what's my purpose?" wondered Isabel.
I don't know, said Hugo. The two of them stared at the clock, and then they put away all the toys, including the little mouse, and closed the booth. They collected the money they had made, and Isabel put it in her pocket.
Before you go home, come with me, Hugo said, and he helped Isabel through the nearest air vent into the walls.
Between Hugo's injured hand and Isabel's sprained foot, it was extremely difficult for them to get up the staircases and the ladder, but they helped each other, and at last they came to the glass clocks that overlooked the city. The clocks were supposed to be lit from the inside, but the wiring had long ago stopped working.
It's so beautiful, said Isabel. It looks like the whole city is made out of stars. Sometimes I come up here at night, even when I'm not fixing the clocks, just to look at the city. I like to imagine that the world is one big machine. You know, machines never have any extra parts. They have the exact number and type of parts they need. So I figure if the entire world is a big machine, I have to be here for some reason. And that means you have to be here for some reason, too.
They watched the stars, and they saw the moon hanging high above them. The city sparkled below, and the only sound was the steady rhythmic pulse of the clock's machinery. Hugo remembered another movie he and his father had seen a few years earlier, where time stops in all of Paris and everyone is frozen in their tracks. But the night watchman of the Eiffel Tower and some passengers who land in an airplane are mysteriously able to move around the silent city.
What would that be like?
Even if all the clocks in the station break down, thought Hugo, time won't stop. Not even if you really want it to. Like now. Chapter 7. The Visit. Soon, the children had raised enough money for the old man's medicine, which Isabel bought at the local pharmacy. But it had been a difficult week. Hugo, as he walked through the station, watched the clocks begin to break down. They all had slightly different times. Most terrifying of all, the station inspector had written a note to Hugo's uncle and attached it to the latest paycheck, asking for a face-to-face meeting. Hugo didn't know what to do. He just kept praying that he could avoid the station inspector until his questions about the mechanical man had been answered. At last it was the night before the visit from Etienne and René Tabard. Hugo could hardly fall asleep, and when he did, he dreamed about a terrible accident that occurred in the train station 36 years ago, which people still talked about. Hugo had heard stories about the accident from the time he was very young. A train had come into the station too fast. The brakes had failed, and the train slammed through the guardrail, jumped off the tracks, barreled across the floor of the station, rammed through two walls, and flew out the window, shattering the glass into a billion pieces. In his dream, Hugo was walking by himself outside the train station when he heard a loud crash and looked up. A train was falling on him from the sky. Hugo woke in a sweat. Hungry and afraid to go back to sleep, Hugo climbed out of bed and got dressed. He walked down into the train station and stole a bottle of milk. He was happy to find a tray of fresh croissants that had been left unattended near a delivery door. He took a couple of them and hurried back to his room, where he ate and waited until it was time for the meeting. It was raining, and Hugo arrived just as Etienne and Monsieur Tabard approached with their two black umbrellas. Monsieur Tabard held some kind of large package under his arm. Isabel called to them from the window and met them downstairs on her crutches. Everyone closed their umbrellas and shook off the water before moving inside the doorway. Etienne hugged Isabel, and she told them all to remove their shoes.
Papa George hates having shoes in the house.
Monsieur Tabard said, Please tell me again your godfather's full name.
George Melies, said Isabel.
So it's true.
He stared at Isabel for a few moments, then caught himself and said,
It's very nice to meet you, young lady. I hope this is a good time for our visit.
Yes, said Isabel, I think so. Papa George is feeling a little better.
They are expecting us, are they not? Asked Monsieur Tabard.
Please come upstairs.
Isabel asked everyone to wait for a moment in the hallway, where Monsieur Tabard put down the large package he was carrying. Then, glancing nervously at Hugo, Isabel entered the apartment. The visitors could hear voices, and finally, Isabel returned and brought them inside.
Please don't be mad, Mama Jean.
The old woman had been chopping vegetables, and she was holding a very large, shiny knife when she turned to see the three visitors enter her home.
Who are these people, Isabel?
The knife glinted in the dull light of the apartment. Etienne and Monsieur Tabard took a step backward. Hugo reached inside his wet jacket and took out the book that he had borrowed from the film academy. He handed it to Isabel.
We found out who Papa George was,
she said to her godmother.
Hugo found this book. It told us about his movies. Monsieur Tabard wrote the book, and Etienne is his student. Please, Mama Jean, they want to help. They love Papa George's films.
Monsieur Tabard straightened his bow tie and carefully stepped forward. I deeply apologize. We thought you were expecting us. We will leave immediately and return upon your request. The old woman, realizing she was brandishing a very sharp weapon, hastily put it down and wiped her hands on her apron.
Please, keep your voices down. My husband is sleeping. I'm sorry. I wish that my goddaughter had told me about your visit, because we could have avoided this uncomfortable scene. I'm afraid I will not be inviting you back. Please, Mama Jean, don't make them leave.
Madame Melies, I don't want to impose on you, said Monsieur Tabard, but if this is, in fact, to be the only time we meet, please, let me tell you a brief story. I met your husband a long time ago when I was a little boy. My oldest brother was a carpenter whom your husband employed on many of his earliest films. He often brought me with him to the studio where the movies were being made. I remember it like I was there just yesterday. I remember how the sun shone through all the glass. I thought it looked like a palace in a fairy story. One afternoon, your husband appeared and shook my hand, and he said something to me that I've never forgotten. Monsieur Tabard paused for a moment, glanced toward the closed bedroom door, and then continued. He bent down on one knee and whispered to me, If you've ever wondered where your dreams come from when you go to sleep at night, just look around. This is where they are made. I grew up wanting to make dreams, too. Your husband gave me a great gift that day. I hope one day I can repay him. Hugo remembered what his father had said about seeing his first movie as a child. He had said it was like seeing your dreams in the middle of the day. The old woman lifted the bottom edge of her apron and wiped it across her brow. I need to sit down, she said. Isabel brought a chair to her, and she sat with a sigh. My husband was an important man, she said, and I am pleased that you remember his films with such fondness, but he's become so fragile. It's not a good idea to dredge up the past for him. We brought some of that past with us, said Monsieur Tabard. But if you don't think—
What did you bring?
Asked Isabel. The old woman raised her eyebrows. When I was invited here to meet a man I thought had died, I must admit I was skeptical. But stirred by my fond memories of Georges Méliès, I sent Etienne down to the Film Academy archives, and in the very back, under a pile of old boxes, he found one of your godfather's movies. It's a little dusty, but I think it's in pretty good shape. We brought a projector with us in case he wanted to see it. We figured it might have been a long time since he's seen one of his films. Hugo and Isabel grabbed each other.
Show us, said Hugo.
No, I don't want to wake up George, said the old woman.
Oh, please, let's watch it now, please, said Isabel.
The old woman looked toward the closed door of the bedroom and touched the brooch at her neck. Her eyes shimmered momentarily with curiosity. At least, that's what Hugo thought he saw. She covered her eyes with her hands as though the light was too bright. Then she shook her head and said,
Be quick with it.
Monsieur Tabard and Etienne got the package from the hallway and unpacked the projector. They set it up on the table and took out the film reel. Etienne threaded the film through the projector and plugged the machine into an electrical outlet. Hugo closed the curtains. They aimed the projector toward one of the walls and turned it on. It clattered to life, and then the film began moving through it as light burst onto the wall. Images appeared, including Georges Méliès himself as a young man, dressed in a fake white beard and a black cape covered with stars and moons. Hugo recognized the designs. When it had fallen out of the broken box in the armoire, he had thought the black fabric was a blanket, but now Hugo realized it was a costume from the movie A Trip to the Moon. Hugo thought the movie was the most wonderful thing he had ever seen. He imagined his father, once upon a time, as a little boy, sitting in the dark, watching this very same movie, staring into the face of the man in the moon. When the film was over, the end of it whipped noisily around and around the take-up reel until Etienne turned off the machine and the rectangle of light disappeared. Everything was silent. But then the floorboards creaked and they all turned. Georges Méliès was standing in the bedroom doorway with tears in his eyes.
"I would recognize the sound of a movie projector anywhere," he said.
His wife was crying too. She walked over and put her arm around her husband.
"Who are these people?" he said.
Isabel introduced him to Etienne and Monsieur Tabard.
"Monsieur Tabard teaches at the French Film Academy," she said, "and Etienne is one of his students. They are fans of yours."
The two of them shook his hand.
"What are they doing here?"
Isabel explained about the automaton and how Hugo had saved it from the fire.
"He fixed it and... I'm sorry, I did a bad thing. I stole a key from Mama Jean. But Hugo saw the key around my neck and realized it would fit in the automaton. We wound it up and the machine drew a picture and then we found out everything."
Her godfather smiled.
"Not everything, I'm sure."
Hugo reached into his pocket and took out the automaton's drawing, which he had taped back together, and handed it to the old man, who took it in his shaking hands. Everyone was silent for a long time.
"Give me the projector,"
the old man finally said.
"What?"
asked his wife. He walked over to the machine and unplugged it. He lifted it up and carried it into his room. Then he shut the door and locked it. Chapter 8. Opening the Door. The old woman knocked on the door.
"George, what are you doing?"
Everyone waited anxiously, but the old man didn't answer. There was no noise at all coming from inside.
"George," the old woman said as calmly as she could, "please unlock the door."
She knocked again, but still he didn't answer. Suddenly, there came a crash that was so loud they all felt it in their bones. Everyone jumped and ran to the bedroom door. It sounded as if the door of the armoire was being ripped off its hinges, or the dresser was being overturned, or worse, the old man had fallen and smashed his head. There was another moment of silence, but then they heard footsteps crashing back and forth across the room, and words they couldn't understand. The old woman threw herself against the door.
"George, George, I'm sorry, please let us in."
Everyone continued to hear terrible sounds, things being dragged across the room, banging and hammering, and low guttural noises interspersed by periods of quiet. The children were terrified, and Isabel's godmother was sobbing. Etienne and Monsieur Tabard tried forcing the door open, but it wouldn't budge. The noises grew louder and more terrifying. All of them tried to push against the door, but it was no use. Finally, Hugo remembered.
"Isabel, pick the lock."
Moments later, after she had finished, they pushed the door open, and the five of them stood there, expecting to see a huge mess, ripped up drawings, chaos. But that's not what they saw at all. The bed had been pushed to the side. Georges Méliès was sitting at a desk that he had dragged to the center of the room, a pen poised in his hand as though he were a giant version of the automaton. Hugo could see the automaton's drawing on the desk. The old man had broken off the armoire doors to get to his old drawings, and now they completely covered the floor, radiating from the foot of the desk
creeping up over the bed and across the walls where they had been tacked all the way up to the ceiling. The curtains were drawn shut, and the projector was sitting on one of the bedside tables that had been pulled over so it faced him from the doorway. The movie camera projected the film across the entire wall. Images of the moon and the rocket and the explorers shimmered across the old man's face and onto the sea of his beautiful drawings tacked to the wall behind him.
"My parents were shoemakers, did you know that?" he asked as he looked toward Hugo and Isabel. "They wanted me to work in their factory, but I hated shoes. The only thing I liked about it was the machinery. I taught myself how to fix the machines, and I dreamed about getting away and becoming a magician. So when I was finally old enough, I sold my share of the factory and bought a magic theater. My wife was my assistant. We were very happy. I had a special workroom in the back where I built my automaton, and my audiences loved him. Then the Lumiere brothers invented the movies. I immediately fell in love with their invention, and I asked them to sell me a camera. The Lumiere brothers refused my request, so I was forced to build my own, which I did, using leftover parts from my automaton. I soon found out that I wasn't the only magician to turn to cinema. Many of us recognized that a new kind of magic had been invented, and we wanted to be a part of it. My beautiful wife became my muse, my star. I made hundreds of movies, and we thought it would never end. How could it? But the war came, and afterward there was too much competition and everything was lost. I hated telling all my employees that I couldn't support them anymore. And just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, two of my dearest friends, a young cameraman and his wife, were killed in a terrible car accident. But their baby daughter survived.
Me? Said Isabel.
You.
My father made movies with you?
Your father was the cameraman on my last several movies. Your mother was a teacher at a local school, and I loved them very much. After they died, you came to live with us. You were the only bright spot in a very dark world. I made my wife promise she would never talk about my movies again. I shut the door on my past. I burned my old sets and costumes. I was forced to sell my movies to a company that melted them down and turned them into shoe heels. With the money I made from the sale of my films, I bought the toy booth, where I've been trapped ever since, listening to the sounds of shoe heels clicking against the floor, the sound of my films disappearing forever into the dust. I was haunted by those ghosts for so many years. The only thing I couldn't bring myself to destroy was the automaton, which I donated to the local museum. But they never put it on display, and then the museum itself burned. The only thing left was the extra key I had made for my wife as an anniversary present long ago, and even that disappeared eventually. I thought the automaton was gone forever, but I was wrong. Miraculously, it survived. Tell me, where is it now?
I have it, at the train station, said Hugo.
What is it doing at the train station?
That's a very long story, said Hugo.
Bring it to me.
Yes, sir, Hugo said. I'll be right back.
Chapter 9. The Ghost in the Station. Hugo put on his shoes and raced through the rain back to the train station, which was still crowded with travelers. He had no idea how he was going to manage it, but he couldn't wait to bring the automaton to George Méliès. He shook himself dry like a dog and sprinted across the crowded halls, excitement coursing through his body. His hand was hurting, and he knew it was going to be hard to carry the automaton back to the old man, so he stopped at the cafe to get some more ice. Making sure no one was watching, he grabbed a handful, as well as another bottle of milk. The newspaper vendor was talking with the owner of the cafe.
I don't believe it. Here, are you sure this is true, Madame Emile?
Said the newspaper man.
Yes, Monsieur Frick, she answered. My friend cleans the police station, and she overhears a lot, said Madame Emile. I saw her on my way to work this morning. She told me that the police found a body at the bottom of the Seine a few days ago.
Hugo wanted to leave, but there was something about the woman's tone that made him stay. He crouched by the side of the cafe.
No one knows about this yet, but they will, continued Madame Emile. The river was being dredged, and they found the body of a man down there. He'd been at the bottom of the river for a very long time, years maybe. My friend said that last night they finally figured out who it was, and they were only able to identify him by the silver flask clinging to an inside pocket. It took them a while to clean it off and read the name inscribed on the bottom. Guess who it turned out to be?
Hugo already knew the answer.
Remember the drunken old timekeeper of the station? Continued Madame Emile. It was him, dead for years.
Hugo knew she was wrong about that. Uncle Claude could only have been dead for a few months, but he wasn't going to correct her.
Oh, my, said Monsieur Frick,
who was used to being the one who knew things first.
Well, I guess nobody seemed to miss him.
But don't you see what this means? Madame Emile said. The clocks in the station should have stopped working when he drowned, since no one was taking care of them. But they didn't. They kept running perfectly. The timekeeper was resting comfortably at the bottom of the river. Obviously, he didn't want to be bothered, and his ghost kept the clocks running. But then they went and disturbed him, and haven't you noticed?
The clocks are all breaking down. The station is haunted.
At that moment, Hugo accidentally dropped the ice and the bottle of milk, which shattered loudly on the stone floor. As Madame Emile spun around and spotted him, she yelled,
My milk! So you're the one who's been stealing from me!
Hugo ran into the crowds as quickly as he could and disappeared into the walls, his head still reeling from what he had just heard. Back in his room, he took a few minutes to catch his breath. Then, because he had to get back to Isabel's house as quickly as possible, he moved all the boxes away from the automaton's hiding place. He dragged the machine into the room and walked around it a few times, trying to figure out the best way to lift it up with his injured hand. Finally, he made sure it was completely covered with the fabric so it would be protected from the rain. Then he leaned the mechanical man into the crook of his elbow. With his good hand, he managed with great difficulty to lift it up. He yelped in pain and staggered toward the door, which, out of habit, he had closed behind him when he came in. He knew he would have to put down the mechanical man to open the door, and he was trying to figure out the least painful way to do that when there was a knock.
Isabel?
Hugo said.
With a great deal of force, the door flew open, and for a moment, all Hugo could see was green.
The station inspector burst in like a hurricane, followed immediately by Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick. The station inspector grabbed Hugo by the arm. Hugo yelled out, and to his horror, he dropped the mechanical man, which landed on the ground with an awful ringing crash.
That's him, yelled Madame Emile. He's been stealing milk and croissants from me for months.
I saw the whole thing, cried Monsieur Frick. He's a thief.
Thank you both very much. I'm glad you were able to follow the boy. Now please, I'll take care of things from here.
What is this place?
Asked Monsieur Frick, looking around.
It's the timekeeper's apartment, said the station inspector.
The timekeeper? Shrieked Madame Emile.
Turning white as ghosts, she and Monsieur Frick ran from the doorway of Hugo's room. The station inspector rolled his eyes and now focused his attention on Hugo, who was writhing in his arms.
Stay still, he shouted.
But his face changed immediately from anger to confusion when he looked down at the bundle lying on the floor.
What is going on in here? What is that?
Other details about the station inspector, things that Hugo had never noticed before, came into focus. The man had bad teeth.
The top part of one of his ears was missing.
He smelled slightly of cabbages. The station inspector, not letting go of Hugo, leaned over and moved the fabric until he could see the mechanical man lying on its side, its neck bent backward.
"What in the world?" he said.
The station inspector walked around the room, dragging Hugo after him, poking his head into doors and cabinets. At last, he came to the pile of Uncle Claude's unopened paychecks.
"What has happened to the timekeeper? How did you know about his apartment here in the station and the tunnels in the walls? Where is he?"
"Please, my fingers are broken. Grab my other arm. It hurts too much," Hugo cried.
The station inspector saw the bandages and loosened his grip, at which point, like a wild animal, Hugo escaped.
"You! Hey! Get back here!" "Hey! Hey, you! Stop! Stop, you rat! Stop!"
Crash! Hugo smashed into someone's back, fell to the floor, looked up, and saw the hand of the station inspector as it closed in on him. He tried to roll the other way, but he found himself stopped by Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick, who descended on him through the crowd like vultures. They grabbed Hugo roughly and dragged him to his feet.
"Let me go!" cried Hugo.
Hot tears welled in his eyes. The station inspector leaned in close to Hugo's face as the cafe owner and the newspaper man held tightly to each arm.
"The only place you're going is to prison," the station inspector hissed.
Chapter 10. A train arrives in the station.
"What should we do with him?" asked Monsieur Frick.
"Follow me," said the station inspector, who led them back to his office.
He opened the metal cell in the corner, and they threw Hugo inside. Then he quickly locked the cage, which Hugo had always feared so much, and tucked the key back into his pocket. The station inspector turned to Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick.
"I promise you both he won't escape this time. I'll call the police, and you'll never be bothered by this slippery rat again."
The station inspector smiled when he said this, but it wasn't a friendly smile. It was a mean and dangerous smile. Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick bid farewell to the station inspector, leaving him alone with Hugo. The station inspector called the police station. Then he said to Hugo,
"Are you sure you don't want to confess now?"
"No."
"Well then, I'll be back with a few of my friends. Don't go anywhere while I'm away."
The station inspector laughed as he left the office and closed the door behind him. Hugo sat there like an animal, wet and shivering in the corner of his cage. He wished Isabel were here with one of her bobby pins. Hugo was left by himself for a long time. He was going to be put in prison now, or an orphanage, he was sure of it. The mechanical man would be thrown away. He would never see Isabel or her godparents again. He covered his eyes with his hands. Finally, the door to the office opened, and in came the station inspector with two policemen. Hugo stood up and tried to back himself farther into the corner of the tiny cage.
"He won't talk?" said one of the policemen.
"Nothing," said the station inspector.
"Well, maybe a ride to the police station will help out a little. Come on, boy, your limo is waiting."
The station inspector opened the cage, and Hugo saw his opportunity. Once again, he made a dash for it. He slipped between the police officers and ran back into the station. It was crowded today, and Hugo was bounced from person to person as they shuffled through the station. By the time he came into a clearing, he had lost his sense of direction. He turned and saw the station inspector coming closer, with the two policemen right behind him. Hugo thought he saw Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick closing in quickly, too. He kept running and was knocked over by some travelers rushing to catch their train. He landed on his hand and screamed in pain. He managed to get back up, and then, with tears blurring his vision and desperately trying to reach the front doors of the station, he stumbled and ran in exactly the wrong direction. He tripped and fell several feet down onto the tracks. He looked up into the face of a train barreling into the station. From somewhere behind him, he thought he heard a scream. The horrible sound of the brakes being pulled, coupled with the metallic screech of the wheels against the rails, made it seem like the whole station was about to collapse around him. The black engine was zooming right toward Hugo, and he was caught, unable to look away, as though he were watching a movie. At the last possible moment, Hugo was yanked up off the tracks to safety. Smoke billowed out of the slowing engine as a shower of sparks flew from every wheel. Hugo felt dizzy. There were a few moments of dazed silence, then steam was released from somewhere, and it made a sound like the train was sighing. For everyone on the train, nothing extraordinary had happened. They had simply pulled into the station. But for Hugo, his entire world was ending. Again, the station inspector was holding his arm, his injured hand throbbing with pain. He could see the policemen removing handcuffs from their belts, and finally, the pain and the terror grew too much. When Hugo opened his eyes, all he could see were stars. Stars and moons and what looked like a rocket ship. It was the cape from a trip to the moon, and George Méliès was wearing it.
"Ah, welcome back, Hugo Cabret," he said,
holding the boy's head in his lap on a bench in the station inspector's office. Standing behind Hugo was Isabel, leaning on her crutches.
"Drink this," she said as she handed him a cup of water. "I knew something was wrong," she continued. "It was taking you much too long to come back home. Papa George insisted on coming with me."
The station inspector reached forward for Hugo, but the old man said in his most dramatic voice,
"Take your hands off of him."
"I'm sorry, sir, but as I was saying earlier, this boy was caught stealing from the cafe and from the timekeeper, who has disappeared mysteriously. We believe he might be involved."
Hugo saw that Madame Emile and Monsieur Frick had made their way into the office, and were listening to everything.
"Tell him what you know, Hugo," said George Méliès.
Hugo gazed up into his eyes, which looked more gentle and welcoming than he had ever seen before. He whispered,
"It's fine, Hugo. You're coming home with us. Now tell the station inspector what you know."
Hugo looked up at the station inspector.
"The timekeeper was my uncle, and I was his apprentice, but he drank, and he disappeared a while back, and I had to steal milk and croissants because I was hungry, and I've been taking care of the clocks ever since, and now he's dead, and it will be in the papers tomorrow."
The station inspector studied Hugo, his eyebrows scowling. After what felt like an eternity, he unexpectedly started to laugh. The two policemen standing behind him looked confused.
"You?" said the station inspector. "You've been keeping the clocks running in this entire station. By yourself. A boy of 10, ha!"
"I'm 12, said Hugo.
The station inspector continued to laugh.
"Well, old man, your little friend has quite a good imagination. Don't you think we would know if the timekeeper was dead?"
"He is dead," said Madame Emile. "The boy is telling the truth."
"I'll vouch for that," said Monsieur Frick.
"But what was that thing you were stealing in the timekeeper's apartment?"
"I wasn't stealing it," said Hugo,
who looked up at the old man and said,
"I dropped it. It's broken again."
"I'm not worried about that. I think between the two of us, we can have it fixed up pretty quickly."
George Méliès turned to the station inspector.
"You can't steal something that you already own, now can you? That machine is his. We'll figure out how to repay you, madame, for the milk and the croissants. But now, I think it's time for us to get out of this station."
He helped Hugo stand. The children were enveloped by the soft folds of the old man's cape, and together, they all headed home. Chapter 11. The Magician. Hugo finished putting on his tuxedo. He rubbed the buttons and admired how smooth and shiny they were. Catching his reflection in the mirror, he stared for a moment. He thought that he looked almost grown up. 6 months had passed since that night in the train station. The Melieses had emptied out a small storage room in the back of their apartment, and now that room belonged to Hugo. The French Film Academy, through the intervention of René Tabard, arranged for money to be given to the Melies family, and some of the money went into furnishing Hugo's room. There was a small workbench at one end, and it was covered in little mechanical creatures made out of clockworks and magic tricks of all shapes and sizes, which Hugo had made himself. The school year had begun again, and Hugo had a desk for doing homework. His shelves were covered in books, and he had many souvenirs from the Paris World's Fair, which he and Isabel had attended a month earlier. His father's notebook was safe inside a box in his bedside table. His floor was littered with drawings. He had a little drawer just for the ticket stubs of the movies he and Isabel saw together. In the darkness of a new cinema that opened in a nearby neighborhood, Hugo was able to travel backward through time and see dinosaurs and pirates and cowboys. And he saw the future with robots and cities so gigantic they blocked out the sky. He flew in airplanes and crossed the ocean in ships. In the dark of the movie theater, he first saw jungles, oceans, and deserts. He wanted to visit them all in real life. In one corner of the room stood the automaton, which Hugo and Papa George had repaired to perfection. Hugo stuffed his pockets with little magic tricks and cards as he usually did, checked his railroad watch, and knocked on Isabel's door. She opened the door and was wearing a white dress that seemed to glow. In the living room, George Melies had on a tuxedo with his black celestial cape, which had been lovingly mended and cleaned by his wife and was now as bright and colorful as the day it was made, and she wore a dress that sparkled like water. Etienne soon arrived, wearing a beautiful black tuxedo and a brand new eye patch. Hugo picked up the invitation that lay on the table. "The French Film Academy invites you to join us for an evening celebrating the life and work of cinema legend George Méliès." Outside, two gleaming motor cars pulled up to the doors of their apartment building, and everyone headed outside.
"Oh, my camera," said Isabel. "I almost forgot."
She raced back to her room and got the black and silver camera her godparents had given her for her birthday.
"Will you carry some extra film for me tonight?"
she asked Hugo as she handed him the rolls, which he stuffed into his pocket.
"And I've been meaning to give this to you."
She then handed Hugo a photo she had taken of him with his old friends Antoine and Louis.
They all had their arms around each other's necks, and they were laughing.
"Thanks," said Hugo.
He smiled and slipped it into his jacket pocket. Isabel adjusted the camera and the key on its chain around her neck, so they hung properly. Outside, the drivers helped them into the cars, and off they sped to the Film Academy.
"It's been a very long time since I've been here," said the old man as they neared their destination. "Maybe I'll ask to see the picture of Prometheus I painted when I was young."
"You painted that picture, Papa George?"
said Hugo, amazed.
"I thought it was of Prometheus. I saw it in the library."
"It's still hanging? That's good news. You know the myth, then?"
The children told him they did.
"Then you know Prometheus was rescued in the end. His chains were broken, and he was finally set free."
The old man squinted one of his eyes and added,
"How about that?"
Once everyone was seated inside the theater, Monsieur Tabard went to the podium.
"Good evening, ladies and gentlemen," he said. "My name is René Tabard, and I will be your host for this evening. We have gathered here tonight to honor one of our pioneers, Georges Méliès, who brought magic to the movies. For years, his films were believed to be lost. Indeed, Monsieur Méliès himself was believed to be gone. But we have a most wonderful surprise for the world. Monsieur Méliès is here tonight, and not all of his films were destroyed. Thanks to the diligence of one of his students here, Étienne Prouchon, and with help on the weekends from Hugo and Isabel, the two brave children who are being raised by Monsieur and Madame Méliès, we went back and checked one last time. Starting with one film that we found in our basement, Étienne, Hugo, and Isabel searched through vaults and long closed archives. They took trips to private collections and such strange places as barns and catacombs, where their work was richly rewarded. They found old negatives, boxes of prints, and trunks full of decaying film, which we were able to save. We now have in our possession over 80 films by Monsieur Méliès, a small fraction of the 500 he produced, but I'm confident that in the years to come, even more of his movies will resurface. Tonight, Georges Méliès, my boyhood hero, is being rediscovered. Now sit back, open your eyes, and be prepared to dream. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the world of Georges Méliès.
The audience cheered and applauded. The lights went down and the orchestra began to play as the curtains opened. Film by film, George's world was projected on screen for the first time in over a decade. And then, the last film shown was A Trip to the Moon. Hugo looked at Isabel. Tears were running down her cheeks in two thin, glimmering lines. The lights came up, and the man of honor was then invited up on stage, where he was given a gold laurel wreath to wear as a crown. He stepped to the podium and said to the audience in a proud, emotion-filled voice,
"As I look out at all of you gathered here, I want to say that I don't see a room full of Parisians in top hats and diamonds and silk dresses. I don't see bankers and housewives and store clerks. No, I address you all tonight as you truly are, wizards, mermaids, travelers, adventurers, and magicians. You are the true dreamers."
After the gala ended, they all went to a small party in his honor at a nearby restaurant. Isabel took photographs the entire night, and Hugo sat at a table doing magic tricks. A rather sizable crowd soon gathered around him. Georges Méliès walked over to where Hugo was sitting and put his hand on his shoulder. He said to everyone,
"I want you all to remember this moment. I believe this is the first public performance ever given by Professor Alcofrisbas."
Hugo looked up and asked,
"Who is Professor Alcofrisbas?"
"You are, my boy. Professor Alcofrisbas was a character who appeared in many of my films, sometimes as an explorer, sometimes as an alchemist, a person who can turn anything to gold. But mostly, he was a magician. And now he has appeared in real life, right here, in this very room."
In that moment, the machinery of the world lined up. Somewhere, a clock struck midnight, and Hugo's future seemed to fall perfectly into place. Chapter 12. Winding It Up. Time can play all sorts of tricks on you. In the blink of an eye, babies appear in carriages, coffins disappear into the ground, wars are won and lost, and children transform like butterflies into adults.
That's what happened to me. Once upon a time, I was a boy named Hugo Cabré, and I desperately believed that a broken automaton would save my life. Now that my cocoon has fallen away, and I have emerged as a magician named Professor Alcofrisbas, I can look back and see that I was right. The automaton my father discovered did save me. But now, I have built a new automaton. I spent countless hours designing it. I made every gear myself, carefully cut every brass disc, and fashioned every last bit of machinery with my own hands. When you wind it up, it can do something I'm sure no other automaton in the world can do. It can tell you the incredible story of Georges Méliès, his wife, their goddaughter, and a beloved clockmaker whose son grew up to be a magician. This complicated machinery inside my automaton can produce 158 different pictures, and it can write, letter by letter, an entire book. 26,857 words. These words. The end.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Invention of Hugo Cabré by Brian Selznick, read for you by Jeff Woodman. This program was produced and directed by Paul Rubin, executive producer Cheryl Smith, sound design by Cheryl Smith, Christopher Camp, and Ben Picardo. Text copyright 2007 by Brian Selznick. Production copyright 2007 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.